a long program today. So grab a cup of coffee if you haven't got one already. And I'd like to have the panelists for the first panel up on the panel if you can. So good morning, everyone. I'm glad you could make it. I'm Edward McCord. I'm the director of the Segor Center for Asian Studies. I'm very pleased today to offer this conference, a Taiwan conference on Taiwan and the world, challenges and opportunities. Our partner today with this is Danjiang University, and I want to particularly thank Dean Dai for Dai Wanjin for helping us put this together. We're really happy to have this opportunity for collaboration. And we couldn't have done this without the faculty and the people from Danjiang University, so we're very pleased to do this. So we have two panels, one in the morning that's going to focus mainly on Taiwan-U.S. relations, Taiwan, especially in relation to the U.S. pivot to Asia. And then this afternoon, well, I call it regional perspectives for lack of a better word, but it's much more trying to not looking so much at U.S. perspectives, but the context of Taiwan's relationships with China, Japan, other areas, and so on. As what we normally do, I hope you picked up at the front, we have a list, in order to make introductions easier, we have a list of all the biographies of the participants, so I don't have to go through all of their biographies. What I will do here, though, is just simply introduce each person and then turn it over to them to simply do in that line. So our first talk is going to be Dr. Barrett Bannon-Garrett, who's the Strategic Foresight Senior Fellow for Innovation and Global Trends. I love the title. That's why I had to use it.
Yeah, that's the best thing about
that's
it.
Really, that's a really great title.
Made at
the Brent Snowcroft Center for International Security and Atlantic Council. And he's going to talk about the U.S. pivot to Asia, global trends and implications for Taiwan. After that, we have Professor Darong Lee, from Associate Professor at Danjiang University, who's going to talk about U.S. rebalancing strategy implications for Taiwan. And then finally, we'll have Professor Edward Chun, Professor of Political Science at Danjiang University, talking about U.S. rebalancing of Asia policy and Taiwan's opportunity. And then finally, Bob Sutter, Professor of Praxis here at the LA School of International Affairs, is going to act as a discussant and try to tie some of these different papers together. So without further ado, I think I'll turn the panel over to Banning and let you just – and you can either do it there or you can do it here, wherever you're more – I guess if you have – up to you.
I don't have any PowerPoint, so maybe I should just do it from here if that's okay
for
people. Thank you very much, Ed, and thank you all for inviting me. I'm really honored to be part of this event today. And I think it's a very timely. I like the title, Taiwan and the World, Challenges and Opportunities. And since I have very able colleagues up here and my I made the term old friend for Bob Sutter, maybe we don't like saying old friend anymore, but I've known Bob for, God knows, near 30, 40 years. And if there's anyone who can talk about the pivot to Asia with great insight and credibility, it's Bob. And so I'm not going to even really talk about the pivot itself. I think what I can do that might be useful and helpful for this subject in this group is to really talk about long-term global trends and their implications for Asia and ultimately for Taiwan. And so I want to go through it as fast as I can. I'm going to cover a lot of territory. I'm sorry because it's got to give other people a chance up here on the panel. But one of the things I'd like to point to just to kind of frame this is that there's an Asia Development Bank report that was done and released in August 2011 called Asia 2050. And it hasn't maybe it's got a lot of attention. Maybe you've all read it. But whenever I mention it, it hasn't got much attention. The reason I like this report and I want to lead with it because it has two Asias for 2050. It has a wonderful, exciting Asia, and it has what it calls the doomsday scenario. And I think this is a good frame for thinking about the future of what we all have to face out there and really globally too. So the Asian century is a GDP growth from $16 trillion in 2010 to $148 trillion for Asia. Now we're talking of all of Asia, even Central Asia. In 2050, with 51% of a nearly $300 trillion global economy, and 3 billion additional Asians in really the middle class, affluent middle class, with an average per capita income of $38,000 PPP. And this puts it pretty much close to Europe today. But the doomsday scenario is GDP growth from $16 trillion today to only $61 trillion. And it's 32% of a much smaller global economy, which is perhaps $180 trillion. and a per capita income of just $20,000. Well, these are really different scenarios, and I think they're important to think about and look at the factors. Now, first I want to just say here that one of the messages is that we are in a very interconnected, interdependent world, whether we like it or not. And the rest of the world is going to suffer if Asia suffers and will benefit, as it has, from Asia's success, particularly in economic terms we're talking about. And Asia will benefit from growth and economic stability in the rest of the world, but its future will be compromised by conflict and economic decline elsewhere. So global peace, cooperation, and growth are actually necessary conditions for Asia's future success. Now, there are many, the ADB points to a lot of factors, and I'll just mention them very briefly, that are challenges to realizing the Asian century. One of them is growing income inequality within countries, very significant, and I would add in here the incredible corruption we see in many countries. You saw the Financial Times today about Zhou Yongkang and his $16 billion of corruption with all his associates. Very big problem in any Asian country, certainly in China. The middle income trap. Can the Asian countries get beyond the middle income trap? China, India, others getting stuck between inability to move into the high value chain production and wages, but not able to compete with low wage in countries. That's a really big challenge. Actually, most countries have not gotten out of the middle income trap. We could have real competition globally for finite resources of all kinds. I'll get into that. And certainly if there's wide disparities across countries in within the region and sub-regions within countries, the impact of global warming, climate change could be quite severe. And overall governance challenges and institutional capacity within Asian countries. These were all pointed to by the ADB as really big challenges. But perhaps for our discussion here, the most critical factor determining success is really whether the region can cooperate. When you look at that doomsday scenario, a big factor in that is that Asian states are at each other's throats, they're not cooperating, they're in competition over resources, etc. This is a really big question mark. And they put it a slightly different way. The ADB says the region will need to take greater ownership of the global commons, including an open trading system, stable financial system, climate change, and peace and security. Be an active participant in setting the global rules. So this is a big challenge, and right now it doesn't look very promising to me the way Asian states are behaving as I see it, but that's my thing. Well, let me just go into some of the global trends that I think are global but will have a big impact on Asia. And this a lot comes from, I recommend highly, the National Intelligence Council's Global Trends 2030, Alternative Worlds, which is a Kindle book. It's an e-book. It's available on their website. And it was released December 2012. We worked with them taking around the country, around the world for that, including to China, Japan, South Korea, et cetera. Some of what I want to say really comes from this report. Now, one of the biggest trend that they point to in this report, which is rather interesting coming from a U.S. government report, is individual empowerment. It doesn't start with a nation state, it starts with individual empowerment. We have an explosion of the global middle class, seen no more dramatically than in Asia, which has been based on an expanding access to education, increasing gender equality, and of course economic growth. But this has also led for a growing demand for a socio-political change. I think we see the fruits of this, particularly as technology, social media, and other technology has enabled people to organize. My own suggestion here is that we're going to see a world of increasing instability, increasing empowerment of people with high expectations. And I'll look to it. I mean, Taiwan is a very interesting case here with the white shirts and other things going on, but I'll take a look outside that and point to Brazil. And the uprisings in Brazil, the demonstrations last spring, were particularly, I think, symbolic of what we're going to see, or emblematic of it, that we had a concern that somebody felt about a bus fare rise. And they started organizing opposition on Facebook. And pretty soon, this ballooned into millions of people in the streets, a massive demographic, and it became about all the inadequacies of the government. the corruption, the injustice, the failure to produce the services people expected, from jobs to education to healthcare, et cetera. Now, I think, and this was, the political parties were kind of caught flat-footed. What's this all about? That wasn't organized by them. It was organized from a very grassroots, bottom-up, young people with social media tools to do it. I mean, Tahrir Square was one of those. There's a lot of these examples around the world. But what it really says to me is that a rising middle class has rising expectations. They expect life to get better. They expect government to work, to provide services, et cetera. And very few governments have the capacity to really deliver. Our government is not doing all that well. And many governments who are in the transition, the country's growing very rapidly, they're urbanizing rapidly, they don't have a long tradition of a democratic government or even a very functional government, and suddenly we're having, we're adding billions of people to the middle class over the next 40 years, and they're going to expect much better performance, and this is going to lead to a lot of problems. Plus, of course, we see this polarization within countries. I read in the FT today that there's an expectation of an actual Tea Party being formed in France. But we see the nationalism, the divisions within countries. I don't think this is going to go away. And social media, the internet has really actually empowered people to pursue their own direction, whatever that might be. So I think this is we're going to have to really watch this, and we also see democratization of technology in the realm of 3D printing, which I'll get into, and some other technologies, but more and more power in the hands of individual people or small groups to challenge governments. Of course, the technology also has given governments new tools, as we know so well. Any case, and access, I would say, to lethal technologies, to bioterror weapons, to all kinds of abilities, small group, to wreak havoc, and of course, we've seen this in the cyber realm. The second big trend is demographics, and the demographics are very interesting because we're at about 7.2 billion people on the planet right now. Projections are kind of all over the place, really, but probably somewhere around 8.3 billion by 2030, 9.5 billion maybe in 2050. Actually, my guess is that we'll see a decline after that. That, the UN has projections everywhere from 6 billion to 15 billion in 2100. In other words, they have no idea. But what's really the real trend, there are two big trends, a dropping fertility rate, particularly when women are empowered, when they have access to contraception, they're in cities, they have their own jobs, you see a dramatic fall in fertility. Even China now doesn't need a one-child policy to keep the birth rate low. It's actually, I think, well below that. It's 1.3 or something like that. 2.1 is replacement. Iran, with the mullahs calling for women to be baby machines, gets 1.7 fertility rate below replacement. So when women have a choice, you see economic opportunities, et cetera, you see a real fall in birth rate. And that's true almost everywhere. Sub-Saharan Africa is an exception, Afghanistan, some parts of South Asia. But the general trend is actually falling birth rate everywhere. And China, as they talk about, we're going to get old before they get rich, because on the other side of it is people are the aging societies. And this is going to be a very big challenge. I don't know quite what the demographics are in Taiwan right now. We know Japan is declining rapidly in terms of its population, South Korea. That you're going to have the median age is moving towards 50. It's going to get very old, so you have a lot of old people and fewer workers is what the real sign this here. So who's going to support those old people who have high expectations of Social Security, et cetera? And you have fewer and fewer workers moving. I think Japan was 5 to 1 or more, 5 workers for every retiree 30, 40 years ago. It's now less than 2, I believe. It's moving to a very perilous position in terms of how do you maintain your economic growth as well as support an aging population. This is going to be a long-term trend around the world. The third trend that I think is so important is urbanization. And this doesn't receive anywhere near the attention it should receive from the foreign policy community especially. But urbanization is massive. We've already now at 50% urban, and about 3.6 billion people in cities. And I'll tell you, there were 30 million people in cities in 1800. So this, we're moving very rapidly. So we're 50% of 7 billion. We'll be 60% or so of 8.3 billion. And maybe 70 to 75% or more of 9 billion in 2050. And again, these are all projections that you can't take too seriously in terms of absolute numbers. But we're becoming very much an urban civilization. That's doubling the number of people in cities. That's building more city in the next 40 years than all of human history. That's also $57 to $62 trillion in urban infrastructure for those people, those of you who have construction companies. It looks pretty good between now and 2030, according to McKinsey. But it's massive. And how do you do that? How do you add people to all these cities? China's alone going to add 250 to 300 million people to its cities by 2030. And China has been serious about urbanization. That is, it's tried to do it in a planned and coherent way, but also with huge environmental and other implications. But this is massive going on globally. And I would say from an environmental and a climate change perspective, and even broader, that the war for sustainability will be won or lost in how cities are urbanized, how we urbanize. We're going to urbanize. How do we do it? And urban centers can be dystopian nightmares. I've been in Lagos, not a place I would visit again, or, you know, go to Copenhagen or Singapore or other places. But this is really the big challenge of humanity going forward. How do we urbanize? And particularly when you look at the next trend that's so important, which is the food, energy, water nexus. And the demand growth just to 2030 for food is, you know, again, these are rough estimates, but 35 to 50%. For water, 50% growth in demand, energy, 50%. All about adding 50%. That's just to 2030. You get out to 2050, it's going to be a lot more. Again, this is really serious in Asia because you not only are you have more people needing food, but you have the middle class going up, literally up the food chain, wanting meat, fish, poultry that wasn't there before. And that takes a lot more grain to produce a steer than it does to just have the grain itself, three or four or five times as much. So you have this huge demand growth for all these resources, but exacerbated by urbanization, population growth, middle class expansion, et cetera. And on the other hand, you have declining arable land use as you gobble up the land. Particularly China's done this, other countries have done it, and you have deforestation, you have the impact of climate change on exacerbating droughts, look at northern China, India. So you have this squeeze between the growth and demand for resources of all kinds and then the supply as it stands now. Now, I would argue that there's a lot of technological and other ways to deal with that, but it's going to be a huge challenge. You know, what can the supply keep up with the demand, and what happens if it doesn't? We've seen these food price spikes in food prices in the last several years since 2008, a number of times, and even with the Ukraine mess, we saw wheat shoot up in price. These lead to complete the real political instability in countries. We've seen that in the past. It could be a lot worse in the future. This is a big challenge for every government to deal with. Another trend I would point to just very briefly, and I know I'm probably going too much stuff, but certainly we're seeing a diffusion of power. And the diffusion of power has also not only been from the U.S. and Europe to East Asia and to the BRICS, the so-called BRICS, Jim O'Neill's fantasy, which is proving to be not much. But on the next tier, the Turkeys, et cetera. But it's also beyond that. It's diffusion of power to NGOs, to corporations, to individuals, to terrorist groups. You have a much more complicated power dynamic in the world, and states are kind of clinging to traditional notion of power. But, in fact, I think cities are becoming far more important centers of power in the world and will be so in the future. Ben Barber from Columbia just published a book last fall, If Mayors Ruled the World. And in fact, if you look at, even I would say about our country, the United States, that if you look at where we see good governance tends to be in cities, not all the cities, but some cities like New York and Denver and San Francisco, a lot better governance that goes on in Washington, where Congress can't agree on anything. But mayors are tested every day. Everybody sees whether they get the potholes filled, and I point out in Washington they haven't. So I drive every day and see that, but they see whether the schools are working, the transportation, et cetera. They have to build coalitions and find ways of working together with business and religious groups and civil society, et cetera, if they're going to get anything done. They don't seem to think that's necessary in Washington, especially in our parliament, our Congress. But in any case, I think you're going to see that's where governance happens. I would put it a different way. It's very hard to come up with a failing state that has a successful city. If you try to go through the list. If you want states not to fail, work on their cities. That's where growth is. That's where innovation is. That's where the smart people could get together. That's where you have a huge potential of every country is its cities, not the rural areas, even though we tend to focus on rural areas. Our political system does, and a lot of development aid has. But I think AID is starting to shift that. So I think that's really important thing to keep in mind. And I've got a lot of uncertainties out there. the mega trends that I listed up, you know, the food, water, urbanization, demographics, individual impact, those are long-term relative certain things. There's a lot of uncertainties, and I'll just list what I think they are that are so certain, so important. But they'll have a huge impact, but they're uncertain, very uncertain as well. They go. One is governance. Governance within countries, but global governance. Can we work as a global community to deal with the big problems we face? We have a very mixed record on climate change. And nations are tending to get very internally focused and don't want to make sacrifices. Look at the EU, got a lot of trade ties with Russia. Do you really want to put those at risk by taking a hard line on Ukraine? These kind of issues are going to keep happening. And I think the future of the U.S. and China each are very uncertain, and the outcomes will have a huge impact on the world. And the other thing that I'm particularly interested in and spend a lot of time on is on exponential technologies. And I'll just say here that we're in a period of a new upswing in the exponential curve on technology that I don't think too many people have realized. The technologies are all coming together and converging to produce a very new technological revolution. The second machine age by Andy McAfee and Eric Brynjolfsson was just published a couple of months ago. It's a very, very good look at this. You have artificial intelligence. You have big data and the cloud for cloud computing, for making artificial intelligence available in your iPhone to robots. You have robots and both physical ones and software algorithm robots replacing people in white-collar jobs, not just blue-collar jobs. It's going to be a huge challenge, but we're going to transform the world rather dramatically. And I haven't even mentioned biotech and bioengineering and nanotech. All these are converging in ways I'd love to talk about more, but I know I'm running out of time, that are going to profoundly change our world. There'll be far more technological change in the next 20 years than the last 50. And just think of the world before the internet. All of our worlds, our personal worlds, our business worlds, our work world, the global environment has been changed dramatically by the internet. And there's going to be a lot more change going forward. And it's very dramatic. And some countries will be at the forefront, some will be left behind. I would argue that Russia is going to be left behind once again. Its latest shenanigans are going to push them further behind the rest of the world. And I think they lost out on the digital age. They were stuck in the analog age. And that's part of what led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. I think they're headed in a very dangerous way themselves. Well, I'll go to the last thing I want to talk about. And I will just add on the technologies that also there's tremendous potential in these technologies to deal with the big challenges we face in food, water, energy, climate change, and producing far more wealth. So I think there's a potential world of abundance out there. I'm not arguing that it's doomsday and that's it. But it's going to be uncertain. So how I would just wrap this up on Taiwan is I think some of the general things that I think are implications for Taiwan, and not only Taiwan, but first of all, global trends, as I've tried to outline, are going to have a huge impact on Asia and the strategic context that Taiwan's going to face. You know, is it going to be, you know, just Asia, the Asian century in 2050, or doomsday, for example? But these global, their trends are global. They're not just confined to Asia. The future, so the point I'm making here is the future of Asia and the world is highly uncertain. It's going to require a lot of strategic foresight to navigate and shape the future the best you possibly can, and resilience to be able to respond to the things that are going to happen that we don't know when they're going to happen, what they're going to happen, is from extreme weather events that could be devastating, like to the Philippines, or another financial meltdown, or nuclear weapons use in the Middle East. There's all kinds of both black swans, or the impact of climate change is becoming more catastrophic. It's going to be a difficult world ahead, and the more resilient you are, the more you plan for dealing with these kind of situations, that I think the better a country's going to do. Now, I think all countries in the world are going to face an extraordinarily challenging and interrelated set of domestic and international challenges that are going to lead to internal instability and could lead to a very international system that's a basically zero-sum competition. The protracted conflict, economic crisis, slower economic growth, and environmental disasters. I mean, we've got a lot of possible bad things coming up here. And McKinsey did a very interesting study looking at the global economy, six different scenarios. And I'll just give you the bottom line is that the best scenario was when China and the United States were working together, cooperating on the global economy and in their bilateral trade in the worst scenario, which was much more conflictual, failure. In 2030, the difference was $27 trillion in that global economy. Or put it a different way, the U.S. and China each need each other to succeed, and the failure is the biggest threat they pose to each other on an economic level. But this applies more broadly to all of Asia and the rest of us. So we're stuck together, and our own success nationally is very much dependent on how others deal with the world and how they deal with their own economies. So I think meeting these challenges is really going to require we move to a world where cooperation is dominant over competition and conflict. And I think that nations start looking to the future instead of the past. And in Asia, I think that everybody seems to be quite stuck in the past on the territorial claims, on history, and as one of my friends says rather whimsically, that the Japanese can't remember their past and the Chinese can't forget it. So I think that we got to move beyond, because those things don't really going to matter when things potentially could really start to fall apart. So I think another piece of this is simply that I think to meet the big challenges, we need global cooperation in science and technology. That's going to be very, very critical. And if we go toward a very nationalistic, zero-sum competitive world, there won't be that kind of cooperation. So our ability to meet the challenges of the future will be greatly diminished to all of our regret. So, and this includes all the food, water, energy challenges as well. Finally, I think that Taiwan may be especially well-challenged to capitalize on the accelerating technological change to both sustain its economic growth and to contribute, punching way above its weight, to really addressing these global challenges. A lot of very smart scientists and technologists in Taiwan, and I think Taiwan can make a huge contribution in direction of really coping with this larger world. And so I really urge that this kind of may not accept my view of what the long-term trends and challenges are, but trying to think in those terms, put Taiwan in a global context and then a larger Asia context in space and then in time, looking out 10, 20, 30 years and then backcast. Where do you want to be? Where do you not want to be? The Global Trends Report, as I mentioned to you, has four scenarios. Three of them are pretty bad. You really don't want to go there. And you hope to get to a scenario that has to... A good scenario in 2030, it's hard to find one that doesn't include the U.S. and China cooperating, leading to global and Asian cooperation on these big challenges. So how do we get beyond the kind of thing we're seeing, I think, very destructive in Asia right now, to get leaders, to get publics to start thinking, hey, there's more at stake here than a bunch of rocks somewhere in the East China Sea with 150 goats on them. There's a lot more at stake here for all of our people's prosperity and security going forward. And there's some really very, very exciting things in the future, but we could have a very grim one as well if we don't get our act together. So I know I've talked too long, but that's it. Thank you.
Thanks. First of all, I think it's my great honor to have this opportunity to present my paper. The topic is about U.S. rebalancing strategy and its implication for Taiwan. And I'm very happy to get back to the D.C. and to the Siegel Center, especially during a beautiful season. So,
you brought good weather to us.
Yeah.
He hasn't been here before.
Yeah, so allow me to get started. I think that we know that over the past decades, China, the U.S. dedicated itself to the global anti-terror war. But during the same period, we have also witnessed a rising China in the East Pacific region. So I think Obama's rebalancing strategy is so important in terms of how to preserve U.S. leading status, how to manage U.S. China relations, and how to cope with a rising China. So my major focus is that within the context, what would be the implication for Taiwan and U.S.-Taiwan relations? So before that, I would like to say something about the contents of rebalancing strategy. As you know, there are five pillars in this strategy. The first pillar is about to modernize U.S. alliances in the region, in particular with a focus on the role played by South Korea, Japan, Australia, and other countries. And the second pillar is to forge deeper partnership with those newly emerging countries, such as Indonesia, India, and other regional players. And the third pillar is very important, is actively participate in the regional multilateral regime, like ASEAN, EAC, APEC, and other regional architecture. And the fourth pillar is very important because the U.S. pay attention to how to formulate positive relations with China. And the last one is to advance U.S. economic and trade interests in this region. And very important that the key architecture here is TPP. So I think, in my view, there are two features in this strategy. The first feature is that obviously is a multi-track approach. And in this approach, economic trade dimension is the most important thing. And the second feature is that in order to soften the sensitivity, I think the U.S. highlights the need to establish constructive relations with China as one of these five pillars. Although carefully avoid over-interpretation, I think the strategy still has a hidden target in U.S. mind, that is the rise of China. So very clearly, you know that officially the points that the United States doesn't mention anything about Taiwan in its so important strategic thinking. But Taipei has been closely watching the important developments. For example, what does this pivot, Asia pivot, or rebalancing strategy mean for us? Or where can Taiwan fit into the big picture? So these is important things. So I think from Taiwan's perspective, three issues should be closely watched or pay attention to. The first issue is about the direction of U.S.-China relations within the context of rebalancing strategy. It's very important to us, to Taiwan. Basically, I think there are two pictures, two scenarios. The first one is more pessimistic. That means although the President Obama tried very hard to broaden the base of mutual interest, U.S.-China relations still suffer from some old and new conflicts. So that means facing an ambitious China, the U.S.-China relations have been changed from what Hillary Clinton described as when on the same boats, cross a river peacefully together, to a highly uncertain and risky situation. And the second picture is more optimistic. That means we need to admit that the two sides, China and U.S., are in a process of strategic adjustment. It's very important. That means with intertwining interests and conflicts, the two nations' engagements and interactions are far more complicated than before. It's natural. But keep in mind that the essence of these bilateral relations is competition, but also cooperation. So it's the essence of U.S.-China relations. So in theory, I think U.S. has a full spectrum of policy options toward China. On the one end of this spectrum is a policy which aims to contain or curb China. On the opposite of this spectrum is kind of policy of full engagement or full accommodation. So the U.S. actual policy under the framework of its rebound strategy falls somewhere along the spectrum. In my viewpoints, I have seen a minor move from the end of engagement and cooperation toward the opposite since the year of 2010. I think the major reason is the growing diplomatic assertiveness of Beijing. So this is my understanding. And all of these I have talked about are related to the second issue. The second issue I want to mention here is about the political implication for Taiwan and U.S.-Taiwan relations. I think what concerns Taiwan most is still about the theory of ditching Taiwan, abandon Taiwan, or the most recent one, say goodbye to Taiwan. Definitely not what we want to see. Actually, these kind of statements or theory are not new idea, and I think it may not disappear in the future. Basically, I think there are two types of rationale behind this. The first one is that cross-strait reconciliation is based on the free will of the two sides across Taiwan Strait, and in a peaceful manner. So it's very important. So that means the U.S. could be less obligated from maintaining its commitment and support to Taiwan. So it's about the first scenario, the first rationale. The second rationale is based on a more realistic calculation. That means, given the rise of China and the relatively decline of U.S. power, the U.S. leaders may consider that the two sides, U.S.-China, need to work together in every matter. So that means Taiwan or U.S.-Taiwan relations come secondary. So these are the two major rationale behind the theory, abandon Taiwan or say goodbye to Taiwan. And we know that the former Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, once defined Taiwan as an important security and economic partners when he talked about U.S.-China relations, U.S.-China relations in the year 2011. Such kind of remarks are very important to Taiwan. However, I think Taiwan has never felt easy about any theory related to the abandonment of Taiwan. For example, the U.S. of issue of U.S. arms sales to Taiwan is another important indicator. I recall that last summer I talked about the issue in the Secret Center. The point is that although we know that the Obama administration repeated that the decision of arms sales to Taiwan are based on the Taiwan's practical needs or cross-strait mutual balance, and the U.S. has reassured to Taiwan that the decision on armed sale to Taiwan will not consult with Beijing. But still, I think Taiwan still worried about that. Is there any trade-off between Beijing and between Washington? So it's a very important issue for us. And the third issue I want to talk about is about the U.S. balance strategy in trade and economic areas. I'd like to skip some basic information regarding TPP and RCEP here. But I think for Taiwan, the nature is U.S.-led TPP versus China-backed RCEP. And I want to take TPP as an example. I would like to say that there are three factors which affect Taiwan's decision, Taiwan's entry into the regime. The first factor is about domestic pressure or internal issue. That means if we want to join the TPP, that means Taiwan needs to open up our own markets. By doing this, it will easily invite some oppositions from some sectors, in particular, for example, the agricultural industries or some small and medium-sized enterprises. So I think the topic here is politically sensitive. And some even argue that Taiwan is not fully ready for this. And we also face very similar difficulties recently. It's about the dispute over the trade in services agreement between the two sides of the Taiwan Strait. I hope we can have some time to discuss about this later on. And as you know, I think the second issue here, I mean the TPP, Taiwan entering into the TPP, is about Washington attitudes. I mean, so far, the U.S. hasn't been clear regarding its attitude to Taiwan's bid to join the TPP. Officially or on the surface, there are two kinds of explanations. The first one is, I just mentioned, Taiwan is not ready for market opening or trade liberalization. And the second explanation from the U.S. is that joining TPP required the consensus of all the members of the TPP, and the U.S. is only one of them. And the most recent official remark was made by the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Asia and Pacific, Mr. Moy. According to him, the U.S. welcomes Taiwan's interest in joining TPP. He made this kind of remark when testifying before House Foreign Affairs Committee. But he provided no further indication on how the U.S. might help Taiwan to achieve this important goal. But Taiwan realized that the importance of TPP in U.S. Grand strategy. So I think in political and economic terms, joint PPP means the inclusion of Taiwan into the U.S.-led regional framework. So that's the main reason why Taiwan is so eager to join this economic architecture. I think the third factor is about Beijing's role. I think from the very beginning, Beijing has interpreted DPP as one of the Washington's instruments in the rebalancing strategy to offset China's political and economic clout in the region. So China certainly is not willing to see Taiwan's entry into the TPP. However, it is possible for Beijing to support Taiwan's bid to join the RCEP. As a matter of fact, China did suggest both sides, Taiwan and China, find a possible way for Taiwan to take part in the regional economic integration. But think about this. Taiwan's long-standing expectation to join the ASEAN Plus framework has always been frustrated by Beijing. So in rhetoric, Beijing has shown some flexibility and goodwill regarding our bid to join the RCEP. But in reality, I think we still need to wait and see. So all of these are the three important factors regarding Taiwan's bid to join the TPP. In short, I think, from strategic viewpoints, I mean, Taiwan should pursue both tracks, meaning we need to seek entry into RCEP and TPP. However, both options face very similar political barriers for us, because the case that TPP and RCEP have been regarded as the two rivaling framework for the U.S., for China, to compete for economic leadership in the region. So back to the very first question I raised in my presentation. Does Taiwan has any role in Obama's rebound strategy? I think the basic point is that in Taiwan's view, U.S. military presence, political influence, and economic clout in East Asia is so important. And these are the indispensable elements to stabilize the region. And like most players in the region, it's very hard for Taiwan to envision an Asia without the United States. However, Taiwan is not going to play any high-profile role, is my thought, or any active role in U.S. strategy due to some political realities, Beijing's factor. So does Taiwan have any importance in U.S. grand strategy? I think the answers remain yes. The first point, number one, I think stable, peaceful, constructive cross-strait relations were definitely in both U.S. and Taiwan interests. I think this is our most important contribution to U.S. balancing strategy, the number one. Number two, I think strengthening Taiwan's own defense capability can contribute to our own security and regional peace and security. And this, of course, can also contribute to U.S. Asia pivot. So it's not about the number two. Number three, as I emphasized previously, we know that at the center of Washington Asia pivot is to ensure American economic interest in the region. So TPP is very important. So if Taiwan can successfully participate in the TPP in the future, I think this can also in both U.S. and Taiwan interests. So I think these three points are very important to link Taiwan's interests and U.S. interests, to link Taiwan's survival and U.S. rebalancing strategy in the region. So this is my very short presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Yeah, it's my pleasure to be here and present my paper. Since the Obama administration promotes its pivot policy to Asia or rebalancing Asia policy, we Taiwan has grasped almost every possibility to enhance our national interest and has benefited greatly from U.S. Policy. First, I will say that U.S. promotion of democracy, freedom, and human rights in the Asia-Pacific region has greatly benefited Taiwan's position. In the political system matter in international relations, Taiwan has developed into a vibrant democracy, holding regular, free, and fair elections since the mid-1980s. Now Taiwan has been recognized around the world as a model of both economic and development and both economic and democratic reform. Probably Taiwan is too free and too democratic nowadays, particularly given the fact that students and student-led movements are still occupying our legislative yuan and once occupied the executive yuan at least for 35 minutes. Taiwan as a democracy has been granted by the United States visa waiver program. Global Times, China-based Global Times correspondent interviewed me immediately after Taiwan was granted such a status. I answered first why Taiwan was granted such a status. I answered first Taiwan's tourist behavior are in accord with international standards. I think you, China, may need one decade or so to improve your tourist behaviors. Second, our passport security has highly been safeguarded with a special chip. Yeah. And last, I told Global Times in a correspondent by saying that the last condition may be a little difficult for you because Taiwan is a democracy. And American strategic objective lies in ensuring Taiwan remains a secure democracy in the region. For losing Taiwan's democratic symbol would be a major setback to American soft power in the region. And the second is U.S. arms sale to Taiwan. While the United States keeps a close eye on the progress achieved in close trade relations in recent years and encourage both sides to continue these efforts, the strong U.S.-Taiwan security partnership has provided the security and the confidence necessary for improvements in close trade ties. Reiterating U.S. opposition to the use of intimidation or coercion to resolve differences across the strait. In light of this strategic imbalance and the possible China's use of force against Taiwan, the Obama administration has significantly increased its arms sale to Taiwan since 2009, believing that doing so would not only help Taiwan to defend itself, but also strengthen Taipei's confidence in sitting in the negotiating table with Beijing. Also, this arms sale are far cry from equalizing the military imbalance. They have been second boon to Taiwan's security position and have caused China to more serious weigh the costs of any invasion scenario. And third is Taiwan's value as a strategic partner affirmed. Okay, as my colleague, Professor Li Dazhong said, former Secretary Clinton once said that Taiwan is a U.S. important security and economic partner, equivalent to what Benning Garrett calls strategic reassurance, in a sense. Of course, some people may wonder whether it is only a lip service, but I think Taiwan, even if it is a lip service, I think Taiwan can make good use of such a lip service to enhance our national interest. Of course, Kim Moy, Deputy Assistant Secretary in charge of East Asian and Pacific Affairs, also said last year that praised the comprehensive, durable, mutually beneficial relationship between the United States and Taiwan. I think it has been further advanced to praise Taiwan's relations with the United States. Since 1979, we Taiwan have seldom heard such a strategic reassurance. So I think even if it's a lip service, it is still important. Okay, the fourth one will be about why Taiwan is has benefited from U.S. rebalancing policies, that Taiwan is at least partially relieved from China's pressure for the political talks. Most countries in the region has a little opportunistic. On the one hand, they lead China's market. On the other, they lead U.S. security commitment. However, Taiwan is in an extremely difficult position in the face of China's growing pressure for progress on cross-trade talks. Taiwan cannot fully reject Beijing's overtures after taking so many benefits from mainland China. But Taipei must also satisfy domestic mainstream public opinions, which prefer the current status quo. My personal experience in facing such a situation is that in late July year 2012, I attended a KMT-CPC conference or forum in Harbin City, a very big metropolitan city in eastern China. And at that time, Jia Qingling, then political consultation committee chair, proposed in a morning session that Taiwan and China should accept a notion that two sides, means two sides of Taiwan Strait, one country, two sides, one country. In the morning session, I think it is an occasion for political leaders to discuss their affairs across the street. So we scholars cannot express our ideas. In the afternoon session, it's a forum for scholars, and I raised my opposition by saying that Taiwan should not accept such a notion, because two sides, one China, so we'll give a very, very bad impression for United States, Japan, and other nations in the region that Taiwan and China are building a new nation or new country. Of course, my Chinese colleagues like Zhou Zhihuai and others criticized me by saying that as long as Professor Chen is in Taiwan, the cross-trade verification the possibility of cross trade relocation is dimming. I'm not so great. I'm just one of the voices in Taiwan. Okay, and Taiwan has benefited from U.S. rebalancing policy by making good use of U.S. policy to enhance our international presence. For example, okay, when the Obama administration proposed its rebalancing policy in Asia, okay, Japan decided to challenge China's leading position in Asia by having some clashes with China on the issue of Diaoyutai. And we Taiwan was also in conflict with Japan, and we even had a water cannon war with Japan in year 2012. Yeah, 12. One of the lessons we learned from the water cannon war is that the power of our water cannon is not good enough, so we have to improve. But the most important implication for Taiwan's interest is that the United States kept a close eye on how Taiwan responded to China's call for close trade cooperation on the issue of Diaoyutai against Japan. And when President Ma answered, said no to China, and the United States decided to exert political pressure on Japan to have have some kind of negotiation with Taiwan on the issue of fishing affairs. And for the past 17 years, and we had negotiated with Japan on the fishing issue without any result. But in the 17th round of negotiation, we reached a fishing agreement with Japan. This is one of our diplomatic success. And later on, we had conflict with the Philippines. And again, China called for close trade cooperation against Manila. And I told my AIT friends by saying that the current climate in Taiwan is that the overwhelming majority of people tend to believe that the United States is taking side with the Philippines. So I think even President Ma will not responded positively to China's call for close trade cooperation against the Philippines. But such a climate in Taiwan will not be in the interest of the United States. I think later on, the United States decided to exert pressure on Manila. And we are still negotiating on the fishing affairs, but the Philippines decided to apologize for their shooting of our fishing captain. Yeah. And another thing, so far, I think it's still needs more clarification. That is IQL. It was said that China has decided to invite Taiwan's official to attend the annual IQL meeting in Montreal, right? Yeah, Montreal. But China never told us earlier. So we some of our officials or former officials could only have some hints from China. But the United States decided to intervene this affair by and President Obama even signed a bill approved by the Congress in support of Taiwan's participation in ICAO with an observership. Okay, China was angry about that and decided to tell us that U.S. intervention may only cause trouble for Taiwan because their previous decision was to give Taiwan an even better treatment. But I still don't know whether it is true. If China decides to help Taiwan on ICAO issue, I think it should make it clear earlier rather than responded after U.S. Decision. Last, I think my colleague Professor Li Dazhong has talked about TPP. I just wonder whether the current U.S.-Taiwan TIFA talks can sustain, because 3 or 4 years ago, U.S. beef issue has hurt Taiwan very much, and several officials stepped down as a result of U.S. beef controversy. We Taiwan can only produce 7 or 8% of beef, so 92 or 93% of beef must be imported from abroad. But we Taiwan could produce about more than 90% of pork. So I think the U.S. pork issue will cause more trouble for Taiwan. So I preferred, I told my AIIT friends by saying that the last AIIT director in Taipei is William Stepton, right? Yeah. And I told the current AIIT director by saying that your predecessor has achieved 1P mission. This is VWP. And you should achieve the 2P mission, TPP, that is. So I don't know whether Taiwan can make it within a couple of years, because even Kim Moi has promised Taiwan that U.S. is welcoming Taiwan to participate in the TPP. Anyway, Washington's promotion of democracy, freedom, and human rights in the Asian-Pacific region has benefited Taiwan's position. As a result, you have increased the U.S. activity in the region. Taiwan was supported as a strategic democracy, received arms sales from the United States, was affirmed as an important security and economic partner or a comprehensive, durable, and mutually beneficial partner, was relieved of China's political pressures, expanded its international space, and improved to its chance of joining the TPP. Although Taiwan has grasped every opportunity ahead of it from U.S. Rebalancing Asia policy, Taiwan has to rely more on its own in the future. Of course, we welcoming the support from other states. Thank you very much.
Well, I get to thank you very much for this. I'm very grateful to have this opportunity to be on this panel with three friends of mine and on this important topic. Thank you very much for that. Just a couple of takeaways that I have from the three speakers, and because I have an issue that I wanted to focus on, which I guess is frustration on the American side, with China these days, and I just wanted to relate some of these comments to that. Bannie Garrett has a very world. He's just by himself, and he's so inimitable in dealing with these global trends. But he kept coming back to the fact that it's not really good now. Things are not promising, and so I'm going to focus on that because I think we're dealing with that right now. Professor Li and both of our Taiwan speakers had this sense of it's focused on Taiwan. In other words, what are Taiwan's interests? What does this do for Taiwan? Professor Chen says it's working quite well for Taiwan. Taiwan benefits this way, that way. Professor Lee is a little more anxious, but it's all about what the American things do for Taiwan. There's very little here about what Taiwan does for the United States. And I think this is, and we're in a period of frustration in the U.S. side, which maybe we could use a little help. And so this is the point I wanted to talk about a little bit today. Not to exaggerate its importance. But the frustration, I think, is evident with the United States. And it sort of goes like this. U.S.-China relations have been pretty stable. It's not because there's tremendous convergence, but both countries are pragmatic, and they work together, and they want to keep good relations with one another because positive engagement helps them both, because they're very interdependent, and because they're both preoccupied with other issues, and so they don't want to really have a problem with one another. And this has been working more or less pretty well until with an exception. And the exception that's come up is that the Chinese side has been very insistent in the last 2 years on its maritime claims in the East China Sea and the South China Sea. They are now treating those the way they, as far as sensitivity is concerned, as they treat Taiwan. And a wide spectrum of observers see the Chinese advancing their control over these areas. They call it salami slicing. This is a throwback to what Stalin did in the Cold War. And so it's not a very good image. It's negative. It's everything Banning said. You know, it's not good, but it's real. And a problem for the United States, is what do you do about it? Because the Chinese are doing this in a way that doesn't directly involve military force. It's coercion, intimidation, but it's using Coast Guard forces and other means to deal with this thing. And so the frustration shows in two ways that I've seen. On the executive side, since late January, you've seen the executive be a lot tougher on these issues in rhetoric. They're taking sides in the sense that they're directly condemning China's practices in these disputes. They didn't do that so much before, but they're doing it fairly routinely now. Are they siding with the claimants in various ways? Not really. No, the disputes themselves they don't take a position on, but the rhetoric is clearly focusing on what China is doing. It's against norms. They're basing their judgments on the basis of international norms and say this is out of line, and they keep doing that, and they presumably will continue to do that. In the Congress, there have been a number of sessions on Capitol Hill where people have deliberated over these issues, trying, what can we do? What can we do in this, we being the United States, in this kind of situation? And so it's in that context that we have these, Taiwan comes up. And the thing that we've seen, just outwardly, what we've seen, are three different things where Taiwan fits publicly. And they're vague in some cases, and they're specific in others. The first is a practitioner of the First Order in the Obama government, Jeffrey Bader, where he said, we want Taiwan, at least I'm not quoting him, we need to go back and look at exactly what he said. But the idea that Taiwan would clarify its nine-dash line claim in the South China Sea. Will Taiwan do that? Now, that's not official. That's Bader. But these are people, Mr. Bader and others, are people who heretofore have been very careful in managing cross-strait relations. And now he's saying that. The second point is the emphasis on China's deviation from international norms. This is intimidation, what the Chinese are doing. And they use coercive means. And it's outside of international norms, and the U.S. is calling them on it. Taiwan shares the same values. Will they join? Will they join in calling China on some of these fairly egregious type of behaviors? And then the third, which struck me remarkably, and some people haven't seen this, and maybe it's not that important, but for me, the study of American foreign policy has been the study of personalities, watching individuals, and many of you know David Keegan. I'm sure that many of you know David. He worked on Taiwan for years and years and years. And David was, and he worked on congressional relations in the State Department. He's very even-handed. Maybe he's in the audience. I don't want to embarrass him, but I think the world of David, just a pure professional. And David has written a very interesting paper, which he's going to offer at the Wilson Center in a forum on the 35th anniversary of the TRA. And he says several different things. It's on the web, so maybe the event has also often been already taken place. But he basically says one of his recommendations is that Taiwan has to be brought into Americans' rebalance strategy. It's not there, as Professor Lee underlined for us, and it needs to be brought in significantly. And he does, he prefaces that with this paragraph. I won't read the whole thing, but let me just read what he says. Recent developments must change our understanding of Taiwan and of Washington's central priorities in its relationships with Beijing. Events in the South China Sea and the East China Sea demonstrate, if anyone doubted, that growing PRC economic and military power will not be employed simply to achieve national unification, but to assist more broadly China's historical rights and redress what it sees as historical inequities along its maritime periphery. The very real benefits of stable economic partnerships with Taiwan, Japan, South Korea, and ASEAN nations may not be sufficient to curb these ambitions. No longer is China's insistence on reunification a threat to Taiwan alone. And then he goes on and argues that Taiwan needs to be better and publicly, presumably, integrated into the rebalancing policy. So those are three tangible things. Does Taiwan want to be rebalanced, integrated this way? It's all about Taiwan from our speakers in Taiwan. It's all about how does this benefit us? Well, this is a cost. Is Taiwan willing to do this? It's a risk. Is Taiwan willing to do that? So I think that's something to think about because the Americans, some Americans, and this is Jeffrey Bader, David Keegan, these are very centrist State Department types of individuals dealing with the Taiwan issue in an extremely careful way, and yet this is what they're saying. And then if you look out and you talk to congressional people in particular, you can see a lot more blunt types of issues that Taiwan would have to face. One is if the Americans carry out significant military exercises in the East China Sea and the South China Sea in areas that Taiwan presumably claims, what's going to happen then? Will the Americans do that? I don't know. But is this an option? It's a possible option for sure. Would Taiwan remain quiet? What would they do? Then you get a little further, and the rationale, the logic of the administration's position against China's actions vis-a-vis the South China Sea and the East China Sea is that these are against norms. These are coercive and intimidating actions. In the last 15 years, I don't think this is sensitive, in the last 15 years, the place along the rim of China where China has employed coercive and intimidating actions the most is Taiwan. And if the U.S. policy started talking in terms like that, highlighting the intimidation of Beijing toward Taipei, what would the reaction of Taiwan be? And then a final option that you could think about is a military one where arms sales to Taiwan are increased because they'll be beneficial in diffusing China's attention. In other words, you keep the Taiwan option very much alive as the Beijing seeks to gain elsewhere in the Asia-Pacific region. Now, those last three are just notional. They're not real in any sense, but I think they're sort of logical follow-ons if the frustration continues. And I think my sense is it's going to continue because I think the Chinese are determined to advance their claims in the East China Sea and the South China Sea. This is going to go on for a long time. So I'd like to hear what our friends from Taiwan, in particular, what would Taiwan do in these situations? Professor Lee's paper makes it pretty clear that Taiwan doesn't want to be in this situation. This is a very bad situation for Taiwan. So my sense is they're not going to do much. But I just would raise the issue because I think this frustration, I'm struck by it. It's a fairly active frustration right now. It's very current. It could fade. Beijing could change its approach, and that would ease the situation. But I don't think that's what's going to happen. So, I think it will be with us for some time. Thank you.
So I want to give people on the panel, if they want to respond to anything that Professor Sutter said, otherwise we'll go to questions. But okay, we have about 10 minutes for questions. So if you raise your hand, I'll call on you. We have a microphone, and please identify yourself and try to keep it as a question to the panel, and identify which panelists you want to address your question to and keep it as a question. All right. Up front here.
Thank you. My name is Jin Ninh Nguyen with Voice of Vietnamese Americans. I thank Dr. Garrett and Dr. Sutter and the two specialists, Dr. Lee and Dr. Chen, for your presentations. As a Vietnamese American, I also am very concerned with the situation in the South China Sea and the East China Sea. And I would like to hear from the two professors from Taiwan about your position and what you think would be best for Taiwan's position in your posture and your perception and your actual engagement with ASEAN regarding the Nine Dash Line. Because we in ASEAN, especially the Vietnamese, we feel that Taiwan is part of us. You're part of the islanders, and we are islanders, part of us. You are part of us. You come from the sea, and we are coastal nations. We live in the oceans. We fish. And we need to have somehow a common regional structure that protect our own fishermen of the whole region, not just one country. So it's very important that Taiwan be part of the ASEAN architecture to maintain the regional security, stability, and prosperity. So I would ask if you think Taiwan should take a stronger position in the code of conduct and clarify the Nine Dash Line based on the United Nations Conventions on the Law of the Sea, on the international law. It's very important that you be a part of us to maintain the stability and peaceful development of the region. Thank you.
Thank you for your question. You asked about Taiwan's position regarding these important issues, disputes in East China Sea, South China Sea. First of all, I think our government's, in my view, position is clear, strong enough. The first important principle is that we hope that all the dispute can be solved in a peaceful way. I think it's the number one priority. The second thing is that we always declare that sovereignty is our sovereignty, our sea sovereignty. And the third issue, of course, we want to be included in the regional multilateral framework to talk about these issues. But you know, there are some barriers, political barriers, maybe not only from Beijing, but also from the members in the ASEAN nations. But I just want to make sure that, in my view, I think position is strong enough. And for example, in South China Sea, now we control the largest islands, Taiping Islands. So we made a lot of effort to make sure that our sovereignty will not be risked by other nations, other players in the region. But we still emphasize on the using Pacific method to solve the issue. So this is my very short. A response to you. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, I will respond.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you for your question. I think we Taiwan has a very firm position I will use affirm the word, the English word, as to account for our position. Affirm itself is suggested that our position on South China Sea and East China Sea will be very firm. And the first letter of affirm suggests flexibility in the East China Sea. Because we don't have any island under our control so far. And I suggest the international environment, our policy will change from time to time, from case to case, according to international the change of international environment. And R suggests we have a strong resolve on this controversy. And we are determined to resolve such a dispute, but not today because it's too complicated. And M suggested were supplementary strength in a broader sense. But when it is applied to South China Sea, efforts will be changed from flexibility to facilities because we have the largest island, the Taiping Dao, and some island in the Dongsa, yeah. And as for Jeff Bader's demand for Taiwan's further clarification on its 9-line or on 11-line, I think it will be involved. Constitutional issue will be involved because any change of our territories. Under our constitution, will lead referendum voting, so it will be very controversial, and things and in the, it will challenge one China policy and our one China respective interpretation policy. So and another thing is that cultural relations will be damaged if we. Made some clarification on the line or 11-line, another issue is that it will cause some trouble for one China or one Taiwan or Taiwan independence. And now we are not a member of a five-party talks. If we are in the six-party, including Taiwan, party talks, maybe we Taiwan will express our. Position. I think if not, we don't think that we need to make any clarification on the 11 or 9-line. I think I don't think that China will be willing to see Taiwan's further clarification on the 11-line because I think we Taiwan and China. Although we could not cooperate on the South China Sea or East China Sea issue, however, we have on this issue, on the 11-line issue, we Taiwan and China has a kind of a cooperation without mentioning the cooperation. Thank you.
I know let's run over a little bit into lunch. So Michael here, and there's a hand in the back, and then we'll come up again. So,
as I understand it, this one. Michael Yehuda from GW. As I understand it, the when the 11-line was first introduced in 1947, it referred to the islands and not to the sea. Is that right?
Not necessarily true. Yeah, but it but the. Remark may be in accord with the 1982 international law of sea, but it may not be applied to 1947.
Okay. So in the back here. Over on that side, and then I'll get back to you. Sorry.
Henry Hetke, researcher at NARA, retired government. I thought I'd just question what your feelings are on China's economic interests in the South China Sea. It appears to be one of the main issues. You really haven't indicated what your feelings are on it or how to subdivide the area so all can share in the resources there, basically like what happened in the North Sea between England and Norway and the oil riches there. There's a question of how much oil and gas there is in the South China Sea. China indicates it's massive, where other countries indicate it's not as massive as they say. But despite all that, there must be something there. And how to make that a fair and equitable distribution?
Do you want me to ask? Okay. Brief answer. I think China has not yet decided whether it will share economic resources with other nations in the South China Sea. We, our president Ma Ying-jeou has proposed the East China Sea Peace Initiative by saying that even sovereignty issue cannot be solved shortly. The resources in the East China Sea could be shared by the neighboring nations. So far, President Ma, when once mentioned that East China Sea Peace Initiative could be applied to South China Sea, but this is our unilateral position. I don't think that whether China is willing to share its share economic resources with other states in the region. Thank you.
Okay, so then Mike.
Thank you. My name is Wang Yue, and I'm a former student of Asian Studies. About the recent Crimea issue and the ongoing sunflower movement in Taiwan, my question is, are there any discussions about an independent referendum in Taiwan now for both of the professors from Taiwan? And my question for Dr. Sutter is, if Taiwan is going to have such an independent referendum, what will the U.S. do to deal with it? Thank you.
About the issue of referendum, as far as I know, I think there has been no serious discussion regarding the issue of referendum in Taiwan, and people are very cautious to apply what the Kremlin do in the case of Taiwan, because we think the two cases are not the same. So I think we have our own political systems. We work quite well, so we can do all of this on our own without applying the system of referendum to solve the issue, to solve the future of Taiwan. So,
okay, a brief answer is that so far, even the student movement of or people's movement in Taiwan has not yet discussed the independence referendum issue. One of the reasons is that the independence referendum voting and the threshold of such a referendum issue will be very high. And as witnessed in the last two referendum voting in year 2004 and year 2008, none of the referendum issue was approved by the people in Taiwan. So except we changed the current law to lower the threshold of referendum voting, I don't think that any referendum such as Taiwan independence or the abolishment of forced nuclear plant could be successfully approved. Thank you.
Let Mike Fonte have the last question.
Mike Fonte, I'm the director of the DPP's mission here in Washington. Bob, you raise a bunch of fascinating points, and I guess my response is, if Jeff Bader's question were to be answered by the DPP and say, we reject any claim to historic seas and only accept the law of the sea, island features, which seems to me to be where Jeff was going and where certainly Assistant Secretary Russell was pointing, if the DPP was in power and did that, it would raise all kinds of hell with the Chinese. And I guess my question is, the questions you raise, the 3 points, seem to me to be pressure points that the Chinese would object to. And that's fine by me, okay? And I think it's fine by the DPP, but I think the question is, the U.S. has pressured the DPP when it was in power, and certainly even now, to be more concerned about peace and stability across the strait. I think these would raise questions. So I'd love to hear how you think the U.S. policy vis-a-vis these kinds of questions would play itself out if the DPP were in power and were to raise this issue. Thanks.
Okay. Okay. You want to answer first? Okay. Yeah. I think, first, Jeff Bader is not a current U.S. official, so his opinion is only a private opinion. And so far, his opinion has not echoed by U.S. government of governmental officials. So, and so far there is no follow-up echoes or remarks on this issue. So I don't think that his issue about 9-9 or 11-9 could be proposed to Taiwan. And even Taiwan is asked to respond on this issue. I don't think that the current Manju administration will respond positively because of, first, we don't want to hurt cross-strait relations. Second, we don't want to cause trouble for the United States because any one China controversy or one China one Taiwan will cause trouble for the United States. I don't know whether the DPP, the DPP will respond to this issue if DPP is the ruling party. But so far, I think it is only a hypothetical question. Okay, thank you.
Bob, did you want to?
Well, just a note that it's remarkable that someone like Jeff would say this. And it's remarkable that Dave Keegan would say what he did, what he said. These are people whose focus was managing this cross-strait relationship in a way that just what Professor Chen said. And it could jeopardize this to some degree. But we're in a situation of frustration. I don't know what's going to come from this frustration. And I'm sorry I can't lay that out very easily because a lot of it depends on Beijing. Will Beijing continue to do what they've been doing? And if that continues, then I think the frustration on the U.S. side will grow, and the search for options will continue, and so we'll have to see. But I think it's tense. It'll become more tense. Will it be confrontation? No, I don't think China wants to confront the United States. I don't think the U.S. wants to confront China in any way. But I see the Chinese determined to continue this track on the maritime issues. And that, it just gets to the core of America's role, perceived role at least, as a strategic guarantor of Asia. And so I just see a real problem here.
Okay, I don't want to keep you all from your lunch any longer. So I want to, first of all, thank the panel for, I think, a very good beginning of the conference. Thank you. Okay, so I'm assuming that lunch is outside in the corridor, then you bring it back in here. I'm also going to try to get them to raise the screen so we can get out the side. If you want to go out on the balcony during lunch, you can do that as well. This is a city view room, and you should have a view of the city. So.
Thank you for your...
Dean and Director McCall, Associate Dean Olapelli, and the dear friends and the colleagues, good afternoon. It is my greatest pleasure to be here Seeger Center for Asian Studies of the George Washington University. Damgang University is a private university in Taiwan. We are entering our 63rd year. Then over the years, our College of Intensive Studies organizes conferences either on our own campus or overseas. For the past 18 years, our college held, you know, annual conferences with the Shanghai Institute of International Relations. So we held it once every year, alternatively, in Taipei and in Shanghai. Then beginning 4 years ago, our College of International Studies organizes a workshop with the Peking University every summer. So we shall continue to do it in this year. Then we organized conferences in Washington, D.C. some years ago. Then later, we began to organize this workshop, you know, with a university in Japan, like Waseda University and the Doshisha University. At the end of this month, we shall organize another workshop at the Doshisha University. When I just entered, you know, Damgang University as a full-time employee, the former president of George Washington University visited our university. I remember then I asked him about the coincidence of Sino-Soviet Center at the George Washington University and a Korean university named, you know, Hanyang University. Hanyang University has a quarterly, you know, called Sino-Soviet Studies. So the George Washington University was quite, you know, well-known, famous in Taiwan. Many distinguished scholars and government officials are alumni of George Washington University. And you know, my colleague, you know, Alice Wong, is one of the alumni of this university. So this time, we are very happy that my colleagues shared my interest in coming to George Washington University. And the topic we covered, you know, are diverse. You know, we cover about the Americans' perspectives about global trends and the about the Taiwan's opportunities and the challenge amidst American re-pivoting. And besides, we should talk about the DPP and the current leader of China, you know, Xi Jinping's doctrine. So the topics are diverse, and I consider that the timing of our workshop, you know, coincide with many significant events. When we planned it, we did not expect, you know, Crimea, you know, would be a focus of world attention, and neither did we expect there is, you know, student revolt in Taipei. So the at this very moment, it is very eventful. I remember in these past January, we had a meeting in Shanghai with our longtime, you know, counterpart, Shanghai Institute of International Affairs. Then three papers presented were about, you know, great power relations. Our Chinese friends on mainland wrote about the new types of great power relations. And a colleague, you know, from my college, you know, also did it. Then interestingly, the Crimea crisis made the United States have tension again with the Russian Federation. Then this may somewhat influence the Obama administration's attitude toward the great power relations. I remember some 2 months ago, a think tank in Washington, D.C., advised against using the term new model of great power relationship, considering United States should try to coin another term, which may be somewhat similar, you know, in significance, in meaning, with Chinese version. However, immediately after the Crimea crisis, President Obama wrote to China using the term new model of great power relationship. So I assume that the Crimea crisis, Crimea's annexation into Russian Federation did, you know, cause some impact about United States relations with China. And I do not want to say that we are now entering the age of new Cold War. But however, if we reminisce or if we recall the tension between United States and the Soviet Union during Cold War years, then we saw so many incidents the United States had to play the China card. In Taiwan's interest, it's better not to see the worsening of tensions in the world. It's better not to see the United States feels the stronger need for cooperating with China vis-a-vis Moscow. Therefore, I consider today's workshop is very timely for us to review the current sensitive and subtle developments in the world. I read the Asahi Shimbun's report that the Asahi Shimbun felt very anxious, felt uneasy after President Obama used the term new model of great power relations to China in a letter. So the former Deputy Secretary of State, James Stenberg, accepted an interview by Asahi Shimbun. Then Japan was very uneasy about the American use of the term new model of great power relations. When we learn about the term neorealism, then we know that the power is always of the paramount importance, but the structure of the international system is by no means less important. The world is now moving into something uncertain, as that was told by Professor Benin Garrett this morning. And the Dr. Robert Sutter felt that United States was frustrated in some senses. Recently, we have felt that some dialogue with Beijing over foreign relations is possible. So 2 years ago, the Shanghai Institute of International Affairs purposely invited some PRC's foreign ministries officials to the conference. And last year, Edward and I and another colleague of ours, Professor Wang Gaozhen, we also visited Beijing's foreign ministry. Then Beijing then was concerned about Taiwan's interest in participating in the ICAO as an observer. Then Beijing talked to us also about the free trade agreement with New Zealand and with Singapore. Then some kind of dialogue now is possible, but the united support will be of the utmost importance to Taiwan. Had the United States not indicated its interest to help Taiwan to enter ICAO as an observer, then Beijing would not have been so concerned about that. Actually, what Beijing concerned is to support the Ma Ying-jeou administrations in Taiwan. Beijing doesn't want to see the Ma Ying-jeou government got setbacks in Taiwan. So that's something subtle. Now we come to the United States amid the turmoil in Taiwan. Then it reminded me of the democracy model set by the United States. Emerson and Solow advocated civil disobedience. Then that was followed by Mahatma Gandhi. Then Martin Luther King Jr. later adopted the spirit from Mahatma Gandhi. At this moment, I alone do not want to see the confrontation between the students and in the government in Taiwan worsen. And I think it is in Taiwan's interest to peacefully resolve the current stalemate, then if I were the DPP leadership, I would moderate the support, to the students, the Sunflower, movement. In other words, lots of things can be decided, by ballot. What is most important is to have the election due later this year take place as scheduled. If Taiwan falls into chaos, then undoubtedly the election, might be postponed. And it will not be in the interest of the opposition party in Taiwan, neither would it be good, for the promotion of Taiwan's democracy. My university is a private one, and we are a microcosm of Taiwan society. So my colleagues and I, are diverse in political inclinations. However, we have to learn from the Western practice of democracy. The law is always very, very important. Then to listen to the opinions of the students is also important. So a compromise must be sought, by both the Taiwan government and the students. Then my colleague, Da Zhong Li, made mention about some pessimistic pictures painted by some China specialists in the United States. They use such term as abandonment of Taiwan, Finlandization of Taiwan, or saying goodbye to Taiwan. As Dr. Sutter, felt uncertain about the future, I think it is important for Taiwan to reinforce our contact with the American academic community to discuss about the security and the prosperity in East Asia. In other words, Taiwan, both the government and the academic community, should cooperate further with the counterparts in the United States to discuss in what ways can Taiwan further contribute to the world of democracy. We are faculty members from a private university. We hope not only the interests of Taiwan must be looked after, but also the global interest is important. Our college has two values. One is to promote democracy. Another is to advocate peace. We hope all the disputes currently in Asia, including the South China Sea disputes and the East China Sea disputes, can be resolved peacefully. And we support at least our government's dialogue with Beijing. The continuing dialogue between Beijing and the Taipei government is important. We like to see the world stabilized. At least Taiwan will play a role as doing feedback to the world community. And Taiwan should not get marginalized. We should be active. We should be active in participating in major international events and in major international initiatives. Dear friends, with your parents, I consider our travel this time from Taiwan to Washington, D.C. is very much worthwhile. And the opinions and discussions this morning are very rewarding to us. And I and my colleagues will cherish the friendship from GW and friends in Washington, D.C. Let me congratulate Director McCart, on organizing this fantastic and successful workshop. Before closing, I would like to present a banner of our university to Dean McCart to indicate our appreciation.
Okay.
Now I guess we'll get back to the second panel. As I said before, we're moving on to regional perspectives, and we have three great panelists this afternoon, and I'm going to try to act as commentator. I'd like to leave more time for the panelists in this, though. As this morning, I was very happy that we had Professor Lee back with us again. He was with us as a visiting scholar last year, and we had a wonderful session with him earlier, so I was very happy to have him back again. In this panel, I'm very happy to have Alexander Huang, who's an old friend of GW, and actually I know him for maybe 20 years, it feels like, anyway. So we have a very long relationship. Very happy to have him back. And he's going to, I think, put this in the original framework of really understanding, you have to talk about China, right? We have to talk about China and how China fits into this perspective. And so he's going to look at the Xi Jinping doctrine, a preliminary examination of Xi Jinping. Next, we're going to have a presentation by Dr. Joyce Lin, who is going to talk very broadly about Asia-Pacific economic integration, but she also brings special expertise on Southeast Asia. So I think that gives us another perspective. And then finally, we have our own Michael Yehuda, who's a visiting scholar at the Seeger Center, who many of you know has just written a book on China-Japan relations after the Cold War. So he brings that perspective to our panel as well. So if the panelists will join me up on the stage here, we'll get going. And if you want to go use the podium, you can do that as well, so everybody has that option.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
It's so happy.
I want you to use the microphone, though, because
it's... Oh, okay. Really?
Yeah. So either stand there or
my class is much larger than this one. Well, it's my honor to be back. Actually, when I was at GW, we did not have this building yet. Mm-hmm. And I even couldn't find my parking lot anymore. I got my doctoral degree from George Washington University 20 years ago. And that's been a long time. And today I want to shift a little bit of the subject from this the session in the morning and talk about what I see the Chinese foreign policy in the very early years of Xi Jinping administration. There has been a very important meeting and what I call unprecedented meeting being held. China used to have a foreign a full diplomatic works conference, but late last year in October 2013, Chinese leadership had held a peripheral diplomatic works conference. Following a relatively successful presence of both President Xi Jinping and the Premier Li Keqiang at the APEC Leadership Summit and the East Asia Summit in Brunei. After their trips, foreign trips in the regional states, there was a peripheral diplomatic works conference. Xi Jinping made a major speech, which I consider highlights the foreign policy guidance of his administration, or at least in his first term, the first 5 years. The objective, as he said, is to firm up the objective of two centennials. That's the centennial of the Communist Party in 2021, and the centennial of the People's Republic in 2049. And with a very clear benchmark that by what China would consider that the objectives are met. Put them together is a slogan we call, or they frame it as a great rejuvenation or renaissance of the Chinese nation. In his speech, he also identified four Chinese characters, Qin, Chen, Hui, Rong, as the guideline of conducting regional diplomatic works. More interestingly, is particularly the words that he put. He said China should do more beneficial things to make peripheral countries kinder and more intimate to China. In Mandarin Chinese, he said that China should 多做得人心、暖人心的事情 win the hearts and warm the hearts and win the minds of neighboring states. That's a more colloquial translation. And this one, I think, is a general principle or guideline for Xi Jinping's management of its regional diplomatic relationship. Here I listed some specific timeframes to indicate that China, or to prove or support my observation as China focusing on Asia, either as a countermeasure against American rebalancing in Asia, or as a practical matter that China needs to maintain a peaceful regional relationship for the purpose of realizing the two centennials as a national goal in the next 10 years. Especially in Foreign Minister Wang Yi's press conference earlier last month during the Lianghui, or the National People's Congress, a meeting. He gave a very interesting press conference without looking at the notes, but answered all the questions directly and forcefully. He particularly mentioned that there, 2014 will be the year for regional diplomatic works. Of course, he reiterated what Xi Jinping had said last October in the Peripheral Diplomatic Works Conference. And he highlights two things, two events, and he said China would have 主场优势, or the home field advantage, which means that China will host two very important regional events. The first one is in May in Shanghai, the conference on confidence building measures in the region. And the next one would be November. I don't know whether the time would be changed, because in foreign affairs, you know, sometimes setting a date is very important. We hope that November would be the time frame. You know, because this coming November will be the midterm election in the United States, and also the by-election in Taiwan. This would be a little bit complicated for some countries to go to China in November, but we will see whether the dates can be further negotiated. But China will host the APEC informal leadership summit in Beijing. Actually, it's in the larger sense in Beijing, but in a specific location that Hillary Clinton had went. Had gone there before. That was the about 10 years ago, the World Women's Conference in Huairou, near Beijing. I love this city, not because of the land feature, but the name of the city, Huairou, is also show that the supremacy of the Middle Kingdom. China will host these two important meetings right after a very successful year, last year, 2013, in Chinese efforts to improve a better relations with neighboring countries. But I want to highlight particularly a policy pronouncement in between. And that's very interesting. That was about 30 days after the conference, China made an announcement which enraged almost all its maritime neighbors in the East China Sea. China had issued the first air defense identification zone and create a lot of opportunity for, you know, scholars like me to write papers, go on radio, try to collect honorarium from TV stations. And it's fun because as students of international relations, we love eventful international situations, so we can continue to divert our original syllabus to more current events and make our life more colorful. Of course, China's announced ADIZ had cut across the existing ADIZ set by the Republic of Korea, Japan, and Taiwan. So one must think that why in the world that in 30 days that China would change its position, or at least give its neighbors a hot and cold feeling within 30 days. You know, 30 days ago, Xi Jinping said that we need to warm their hearts, win their friendship. And 30 days later and say, you know, we are going to push out this ADIZ to further protect the interest or strategic comfort zone for China's national defense. When China was thinking of managing a better regional relationship, we have other regional players developing different bilateral relationship at the same time. Of course, those pictures was taken before Crimea, and this has been a photo that I think will live a little bit longer. It is quite clear that China has not ready to resume bilateral dialogue or leadership dialogue with Japan anytime soon. And the crisis in Ukraine, and specifically over Crimea, would make more difficult between the United States, the West, and their relationship with Russia. A little commercial, I just completed a short piece on how Taiwan look at the Crimea situation. It will be published soon by NBR, I think in the next few weeks. Then I try to think, because we are scholars, we try to rationalize the events that we observe. So I try to identify three hypotheses and see why China, within 30 days, suddenly changed, you know, from a relatively soft, friendly tone to a very forceful message to its neighbors. The first hypothesis is that China, this is the initial step for China to pursue a long-term objective that China will eventually, ultimately, contend against the United States in the high seas. After all, Xi Jinping has said that the Pacific is big enough for both China and the United States. A kind of visualized G2 concept. The second hypothesis is that China was actually targeting Japan. Nobody else but Japan. Given the sour relationship between Xi Jinping and Shinzo Abe. You know, I put Abe and Xi together, it becomes Armani Exchange, AX. But these two men are not talking to each other. The second hypothesis is that the China would observe and honor the American supremacy or dominance in the region. China would not antagonize other neighbors, but only targeting at Japan. The third hypothesis is that none of the above. China was actually expand its own depth of defense, or in Mandarin Chinese, 防御纵深, at sea and in the air, to defend external threat. That means China put its safety zone further into the maritime region, into the East China Sea. Under each of the hypotheses, we can find at least a dozen supporting argument for each hypothesis and try to prove that we are correct. But we don't know, because we have to ask the Chinese foreign ministry or President Xi Jinping himself to see which one is more likely. And then I continue to develop my thinking based on my observation. My observation is that ever since Xi Jinping assumed the power, his first visit, foreign visit, was to Russia. And China has tried very hard to improve and advance the cooperation between China and the SCO states, the Central East Asian states. And China also tried to roll out a lot of incentives for the further cooperation, economic and security, with the South Asian states. So I put them together with a yellow curve. And then look at the ADIZ, or the recent events, or Chinese more proactive and tough measures in East China Sea and South China Sea with a blue curve. Then I come up with a concept or a visualized concept on the view graph, on the map, that I consider that maybe China is putting their continental neighbors as the 战略后方, and put its maritime interests as the priority, at least for the time being, in China's peripheral diplomacy. Further getting into the conceptual construction, I asked myself why China has tried so hard across centuries, through dynasties, continue to build the Great Wall. In history, China tried to build the Great Wall to send a message to the friends or foes outside the wall. That may be a message that we are not interested in anything or any land beyond the wall, but please do not come into the wall. We are fine. You know, we are quite happy within. Then I asked myself, is that a strategic cultural, a strategic tradition, or a military tradition of China, that their DNA is set, that they are not interested in getting outside of the wall? Try to find proof. This picture was taken earlier, in July 2011, I believe. That was a press conference held by the Ministry of National Defense in China. The first press conference proved that China was doing something about a possible aircraft carrier. That was the first thing. Spokesperson Senior Colonel Gan Yensheng said the first carrier would be only for scientific research and training purposes. Of course, there are many people disbelieve such a statement. Of course, my students, those warmonger-minded students, wanted to debate me about how forcefully, how fierce that the Chinese, future of Chinese People's Liberation Army Navy would be. They even tried to discuss the possible home port and the possible deployment and the use of the first aircraft carrier. I was pretty much annoyed, so I showed them the picture. I say, guys, look at the picture of the conference that day, and what you see behind Senior Colonel Gan Yensheng was the Great Wall. And I said, this is a wall, okay? And if my students were not convinced, and late last year on December 31st last year, when Xi Jinping gave a New Year remarks in his office, and for the first time, the leader's office was shown to the outside world through CCTV, and lots of discussion were on his message. Lots of discussion were on the photos that put on the shelves of his office. But what I look at was the wall, the Great Wall painting behind him. And I was thinking why he chose this oil paint to put behind him. For what reason? You know, we all put stuff on the walls or in our office. And that show maybe our concern, that show probably the very intrinsic, you know, minds of a person in the office. And also our good friend Buck Cole have republished for the second edition of his very famous book. It's called The Great Wall at Sea. So that made me think more about whether the ADIZ was actually a wall, a new Great Wall. But I was not that firm until last month when my good friend in media brought me back from Beijing from the National People's Congress press briefing. She purchased a stamp collection from the Lianghui, or National People's Congress. And I was so happy when I received the gift, but my heart was more happier when I saw Great Wall again to frame this Chinese dream. Then I came up with the question whether the Chinese dream or Xi Jinping's Chinese dream is inside the wall or outside the wall. You know, we can have a dream inside the wall or outside the wall. Now, back to summarize my observation. Though preliminary, because he has been the president for a little bit over 1 year, yet there are 8 more years to come. I think the objective of Xi Jinping doctrine is to realize the Chinese dream by two benchmarks, the two centennials. And the guideline is peace and development. I think it's very clear, at least based on my observation, that the all top leaders in Beijing understand that if they were to make the Chinese dream or China dream realize, they need to continue to maintain a peaceful environment in the peripheral and focusing on economic development. The framework of the larger framework is to address the new type of major power relationship that we have discussed a lot today. And the primary focus is Asia-Pacific region. So I believe, I mean, I may be wrong, but at least based on my observation to date, I think the Xi Jinping doctrine is Asia-focused. They have limited pragmatic objective by focusing on Asia-Pacific region. The guideline for the approach is a good neighboring policy, and the forms would be secure the continental strategic rear and being proactive in the maritime frontier. So, whether Xi Jinping doctrine can be realized is not depends on China's unilateral desire or inspiration. It will be co-defined by the relationship with the United States. So Taiwan is not alone. Taiwan is like other Asia-Pacific countries that we will continue to face these two captains, Captain America and Captain China. Thank you.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I think it is really my great pleasure to be here in Washington, D.C. again. Particularly, last summer, I spent 3 months to be the Brookings Meeting Fellow, and my project is TPP and the Cross-Strait Relations. So, today, I would like to talk about Taiwan's entry into TPP and the Asia-Pacific economic integration. And I'm so glad that my good friend, like Michael Fonte and Dennis Yeping, also John Phipps, I have an interview with these three guys at that time. So, the TPP and the Cross-Strait Relations, I think it's very important not only to Taiwan, but also to the United States because it is more popular in the East Asia region. I think first of all, I'd like to talk about my main concept. First one, TPP has a visible impact on China, especially in the textile and the apparel sectors. And then we all know the Trans-Pacific Partnership has formidable impact on Taiwan in a broad range of critical sectors, especially machinery and petrochemical. And we all know the shift of attitudes of both China and Taiwan has a lot more to do with opportunity than with them, with a threat. So if we look from the TPP, I think it's more than 10 years. The first done in 2003. Only Singapore, New Zealand, and Chile, that's three small countries, they would like to initiate TPP and not allow some more attention. And then 2005, Brunei joined this TPP program. And as we know, in 2008, in Australia, Peru and Vietnam joined this program. And also, President Obama, he agreed to have join this program. And then in 2009, Obama also declared the U.S. would engage TPP and aimed at both. And then so far, we know we have the U.S. and another 11 countries to join this program. And then the last one was Japan. Japan attended this TPP program since May, and have all the TPP members have had during the 20 times negotiated. And then we all know originally TPP would like to be concluded in this April before President Obama visit the East Asia countries. But seems like they are very difficult. And then if we look from the U.S. Strategic thinking on TPP, we can see the three objectives. Number one, the U.S. would like to regard it as a regional institution building. It's a more multilateral trade negotiation. And then we see the U.S. would like to have some more effect of export promotion, like direct effect and the indirect effect, so-called like a hybrid approach to seek market expansion, and then like the competition between TPP members and non-TPP members. And also we know, as we know, we can find more new alliance of the United States, not only the old friend like the Philippines, Thailand, and some the former colonial state like Malaysia or Singapore. So the new friend has more and more engagement with the United States like Malaysia, New Zealand, and Vietnam. They have had some bilateral military actions in the last 2 or 3 years. So you can see in the last 3 years, the TPP program have more than 29 chapters. It's a high standard and transparent. Include, like you can see from the screen, government an IPR, labor, environment, regulatory coherence, and also like very important living agreement, like pharmaceutics and medical instruments. I think it's so many, so you can just read from this screen. So if we talk about the China thinking, you can see TPP's effect on China. I think it will be more and more a rule-making competition. You see this competition between U.S. did deep integration TPP and China's shadow integration approach, like ASEAN plus N, we can see it as ASEAN with six internal and external nations, as China, Japan, South Korea, India, New Zealand, and Australia. So it's more and more important for this East Asia and Asia-Pacific economic integration. So we have some questions about whether in the later stage of TPP or in the multilateral negotiation, or like if you put some benchmarks like state-owned enterprise, SOE, as a determining China's entry or SOE cross as stimulus China's reform. So it's a very complicated. You can see from the from this table. So many industrial that's like in China. You can see the blue colors 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and then from Malaysia also four kinds of industry. And if you look from Mexico and Vietnam, so there are so many like higher and industrial products. They are compared very highly and more complicated. And also you can see if between the secretary competition, Vietnam and Mexico, they enjoyed the export industry more and more, like electricity and machinery, cotton, and also some plastics and some more and more competitive products. So, and also you can see this one, comparing checks and the players. So if we can see that's only 2 years ago, like China, Japan, Korea, and Taiwan, there will be have better interaction if Taiwan can enter into the TPP program. You can see from this table. Okay. Also, if we look from the welfare effect to excluding China, then we can find that some losers in the non-joining scenario, like agriculture, food processing, textile and transportation, and some gainers in the joining scenario as agriculture, electronics, and textile. So I can see from the textile and the apparel, this one, okay? So if we look from the winners and the losers, it's very, very complicated. And then must cost over 1 or 2 years to solve this problem. So like this one, winners and losers. You can see from the screen. So many kind of production for export and import. So and then China's evaluation of TPP, I think there are some problems. Number one, like no consensus on TPP so far. And then there are some skeptics, like TPP is very difficult to succeed. And then the TPP competition in rule making, and also TPP interfere in regional production chain. And we can see the some cautious supporters, they will think TPP offers more market opening, and TPP is the way to go. So you can see so far China has showed its interest to entry into TPP, and they have made some efforts and very aggressive. That's like a very positive signal in the gym last year. So this is a very important, I think, for the TPP potential member, particularly the so-called rising China. So so far, China has showed some interest on TPP, but has not decided to entry. So like China's response to TPP would like speeding up China, Japan, and Korea FTA. That's a triangular FTA, and would like start negotiations on China and Korea bilateral FTA. And also, China has been the dominant power of RCEP with Japan and Korea, as we know. So if you look from the China's motives and the concerns, it's very clear. I think it's very clear to us to think. It's a high economic potential for trade diversification, and then like internationalizing renminbi. That's very important for China. High expectations from Chinese business, and also has a new thinking in developing and in some strategy also, like to link to advanced economies, and then stimulating China, Japan, or like China, Korea, both bilateral and multilateral. So it's very important for China to concern like increasing trade deficit, and would like to avoid locking in effect on China's position in global production chain. And then we can see if you look from the Korean and the Japan perspective, it's some motives and the concerns as the same as China. So we look like Sino-Korea FTA has been in the process. And then economic returns by taking advantage of China's eagerness. So more and more improving Korea's position in CJK, the trilateral FTA. And also, I think it's the same situation as in Japan. We can see the negotiation bottleneck. Japan and Korea demand CJK to be higher standard. And then we can see this, all the triangular relations are seeking economics return despite some strategic reason to have the deal done. So it's a negotiation and some bottleneck here. And then we will have some attention on the Korea and the United States. I think it's important because South Korea has been a strong competitor. If you compare with the industry between South Korea and Taiwan, that's almost the same, like IT industry or some 3C industry. So it's very important for the last 3 years while South Korea and the U.S. Has signed the Korea-U.S. FTA like this. And then I think it's our key point, TPP and Taiwan. who will be the winners and losers. I think that's very important if you look from the, according the IDB and the CIER annual report. I think in Taiwan, there will be some winners like petrochemical, machinery, pulp and paper. Also like steel, textile and bicycle. And then some losers like food proceedings, auto parts, agriculture, like beef and some dairy products. And then we can see currently a tariff exceeding 10% for in items covering something like that. And also we can see another winners and losers like machinery, because in Taiwan there are so many small and medium enterprise. So we have more than 90% companies are at the scope of less 30 employment only. So we can see the major location like in Taichung, Da Taibei, Taipei Metropolitan, Taoyuan, and Tainan. So it's very important for Taiwan to be the major market like China, US, Japan, Thailand, Vietnam. And we can see if the TPP can get access, then we will have outbound investment, 12 million in 2000, and I think in the past it's not very high, but in the future that will be very important. Also, okay, we can see this another petrochemical, and we can see if we have some important FTA, the major location like in Kaohsiung, Yunnan, Miaoli, and Taoyuan, and first hit by China ASEAN FTA, and will be hit followed by TPP and RCEP. So it will be more important if Taiwan businessman has some outbound investment, there will be more and more clear. And then last year, we have two bilateral FTA. One is Taiwan and New Zealand in May, and the other, Taiwan and Singapore, signed the ASTEP. So that will be important for the future's potential and another engagement with bilateral and the multilateral FTA. So I think in the future, Taiwan and the TPP, I think let's have some more political implications. First of all, I think if excluding from TPP will increase Taiwan's dependence on China. Economically, China becomes the dominant market destination for Taiwanese export. And then politically, Taiwan's request for FTA becomes solely reliant on China goodwill. And also we can see we don't have the U.S. Support, then it's very difficult for Taiwan, because I think this coming Friday, U.S. and Taiwan will launch continuous the PFAS talk. So I think it's a Taiwan and U.S. dialogue on trade-related issues. I think it's more and more important. So if I look from the, we can see if excluding from TPP will increase Taiwan's dependence on China, and also has some exclusion from TPP will strengthen rising protectionism in domestic Taiwan. So if we couldn't have any potential to entry into TPP, then we have some anti-China political scenario. And then we also have some economic reason if we less potential to competitive and less confidence in local industry. And some, I think, very important social reasons. There will be environment and other consideration. So I found that I have so many colleagues in the morning. They all mentioned about TPP. So I think we can have a good discussion. And I would like to have the TPP, maybe the Taiwan Power Progress. So I'd like to stop here and welcome your comments. Thank you.
Well, first I'd like to thank you all for staying after lunch and when you're all, I think, looking rather tired. And I hope I will not sort of increase your tiredness. I want to argue that Japan's significance in regard to cross-strait relations has improved greatly in the last few years, and I don't think that it has received the attention that it deserves. I want to say, first of all, something about the strategic context. Then I want to go on to show how Japan and Taiwan have become much, much closer than seems to be recognized here in Washington. I then want to say a few things about what follows from that. And then I want to spend a few minutes just looking ahead to the potential that is released by that. Now, as far as the change in the strategic position, this arises from China's growing maritime power, and it's produced a very sharp strategic dilemma between Japan and China. As China is seeking to move out from the constraints of its near seas, wants to reach out into the Western Pacific, then its ships have to go through straits which are either between Japan or closely monitored by Japan and the United States. And indeed, Chinese naval expeditions into the Western Pacific have generally gone through straits between Japanese islands. There's also the strait of just to the north of the Philippines, the Baosha Channel. Now, if China were to establish itself as a permanent or semi-permanent presence in the Western Pacific, it would mean that Japan's maritime trade, on which Japan's livelihood depends, would be subject to possible control by China. On the other hand, if the Chinese are to get into the Western Pacific, they have to go through the islands controlled by Japan. And in the event of hostilities, clearly the Chinese fear that Japan will be able to prevent Chinese access. So this has presented a new kind of dilemma, strategic dilemma between them, in which it's although there would be possibilities of possibly settling this in some peaceful way, the current relationship between China and Japan does not portend, at least in the near future, any mutually agreeable way of settling this. Now, this dilemma, if you like, bearing in mind, of course, that Japan is an ally of the United States, but not just any kind of ally. If the United States is to maintain a strategic and important presence in East Asia, and I would argue even in Southeast Asia, it needs to have its bases or access to the bases in Japan. Without that, the United States would not really have much of a basis of going much beyond Hawaii. The United States Defense Department have been talking a great deal about the problem of access denial by the Chinese military developments that would limit, perhaps even prevent, American access to intervene should there be hostilities in the cross straits, in the Taiwan Straits. But the issue with Japan adds a new dimension to it. Because if for the United States the issue between China and Taiwan is really a matter of process, that is to say, of the means by which the issue was settled. The American declared position is that as long as it is done peacefully, they are happy to leave it to the people on both sides of the straits to settle it. For Taiwan, it is not just the process, it is the result. If China were to have unity with Taiwan under any basis, even if the Chinese would not seek to establish military bases in Taiwan, I think it's entirely possible that the Chinese Navy would claim the right to visit ports in Taiwan. And from that perspective, China would then be able to break through into the Western Pacific without the problems of encountering either Japan or the United States. And that, of course, would be, as I said earlier, would be a very grave strategic problem for Japan. Now, I think this change, if you like, in the strategic significance of Taiwan for Japan does not affect the immediate policy issues concerning the United States and Taiwan and the United States and Japan. But I think it's only a question of time before the two allies will have to look at this much more closely. Now, let me now turn to the close relationship that has developed between China and Taiwan. Between Japan and Taiwan. Interestingly, this did not take place under the administrations of Li Donghui and Chan Shui-bian, even though both of these favored very much a relationship with Japan. The reason for it, very clear, and that is that the United States did not want Japan to act in a provocative way towards China, and B, Japanese themselves were also cautious about this. When Chan Shui-bian decided to have a or wanted to promote a particular referendum within Taiwan that the United States then objected to. Koizumi, who happened, as I'll explain a little later, happened to belong to a faction within Japan that rather favored Taiwan, nevertheless also added his objection to the carrying out of this referendum. Now, I would argue that the closer relationship has developed rather paradoxically after the Ma administration established closer relationships with Beijing. In his first inaugural address, Ma Ying-jeou did not mention Japan at all. But at his inaugural address of May the 20th, 2012, he said the following: "We have built up a special partnership with Japan, with relations between us the most cordial level seen in the last 40 years." The Japanese Foreign Minister Kishida said in January of last year, "Taiwan is an important partner of Japan, as evidenced by the close economic ties and people-to-people exchanges. Underpinning the deep friendship and trust are our shared values of democracy, freedom, and peace." Now, this is not just something between the elites of both sides. In contrast to attitudes towards China, in 2013, a survey by Taiwan office in Tokyo, TECRO, found that 70% of Japanese felt close to Taiwan, 90% felt relations were good. A similar survey carried out in Taipei found that 52% of Taiwanese identified Japan as their favorite foreign country. The United States came second with just 8%. So I think it shows how much the people on both sides feel for each other. In economic terms, Taiwan was Japan's fifth largest trade partner, and Japan was Taiwan's second. Nearly 1.5 million Taiwanese visited Japan in 2012, and that was the second number, just ahead of China. And a similar number of Japanese went to Taiwan. As far as education is concerned, apparently over 250,000 people are studying Japanese in Taiwan. And the number of Taiwanese students in Japan ranked third after China and South Korea. They've also, in this period, established a number of agreements that were agreed technically between the two bodies that they have in each other's capitals, which are unofficial, but nevertheless involved important ministries and agencies in each country to settle this. So beginning in 2010, there have been a surge of new agreements that have facilitated more flights, investments, patent protection, industrial cooperation, the exchange of information regarding money laundering, terrorist funding, and so on. The closer ties between the two countries was reflected in Taiwan's assistance to Japan over the terrible earthquake and tsunami disaster of March 2011. That came to $260 million. A large proportion of that was not from the government, but was raised by the people. And that was considerably more than any other country. Now, let me say a few words about the new political and diplomatic significance of this relationship. It has served to enhance, first of all, Taiwan's separate identity from the PRC, in being able to conduct its own policies in the East China Sea. Despite having maritime and territorial claims more or less identical to those of China, Taiwan reached, as we know, its own separate fisheries agreement with Japan, much to the openly expressed annoyance of Beijing. Although behind the scenes the United States may have played a role in this, nevertheless, as stated, this was a bilateral agreement. And this followed Ma's peace initiative a year earlier, which followed on from Chinese pressure to work together on the East Sea, East Chinese Sea. And this, as was mentioned in, I think, one of the earlier talks, it involved three elements. One is shelving the sovereignty disputes, engaging in peaceful dialogue, and promoting joint resource development. Second, the Japanese noticed, of course, that Taiwan, as well as China, reacted unfavorably to the purchase of the three islands in the Senkaku Diaoyu group. And again, it's possible that the United States put some degree of pressure behind the scenes, but nevertheless, that in itself was a prompting to Japan, who then immediately indicated that it sought to resume the long-delayed negotiations over the fisheries. And not only was this an agreement, but it was one that had very important and direct consequences for fishermen of both sides. Now, time is pressing, so let me first of all identify the groups in Japan who have rather interesting views with regard to Taiwan and arising to a large extent about their debates on China. I'll exclude those of the extreme right associated with the former governor of Tokyo, Ishihara, who really, out of his views, negative views about China, attaches some significance to Taiwan, but it's not one that necessarily been important in the new relationship between Japan and China. Likewise, I'll exclude the more leftist groups, which on the whole argue, and have argued for a long time, that Japan should reduce its relationship with the United States in favor of closer relations with China, arguing that, or reflecting rather, a long-standing division in Japan about its identity as to how far it is an Asian country and how far it is, if you like, a modern Western country. The latter view has declined in significance as the hostile or rather negative views of China about China have deepened in Japan. In the last 2 years, opinion polls have registered something like 90% of Japanese having an unfavorable view of China. So what are the others? Well, if we look at those at the center, they all share an interest in seeing that the status quo in the cross-strait relations should be prolonged. And also, they wish to preserve the U.S.-Japan alliance, and they approve of Abe's active diplomacy. But there are some who see China's rise and maritime encroachments as a kind of zero-sum game. And there are others who favor a more moderate policy of combining engagement and hedging. As far as Taiwan is concerned, they all agree that that Japan could not replace the United States as provider of security. But nevertheless, they think that Japan could play, if you like, more of a supportive role in terms of contributing to Taiwan's security. Now, in some respects, you could argue that these two debates between seeing the relationship with China in more zero-sum terms and in combining hedging and engaging, if you like, as mirroring the kinds of arguments one hears in Washington. And, of course, being the only major power on China's periphery that could limit China's rise, these issues are of great significance, and they affect issues regarding Taiwan. Now, let me conclude, because time is running out, make a few points. One is Japanese dealings with Taiwan continue to be circumscribed by China and by the United States. The Chinese have long been suspicious of Japanese interests and policies towards Taiwan. For example, you can see this on the website of the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Moreover, the Japanese are conscious that the most important ally, the United States, does not want Japan to act provocatively towards China. It's a long problem with alliances of this kind, in which the smaller ally fears either abandonment or fears that it's going to be involved in conflicts not of its own concern, and the bigger ally worries that the smaller ally will act independently and cause trouble for the larger ally. And this is reflected very much in their relationship. But now that Japan has, I think it came out today, or maybe yesterday, but Abe's cabinet has finally approved the idea that Japan can export arms. And it's in the process, too, that soon Japan will formally accept collective security. So this has opened the possibility of Japan having some kind of joint military-related relationships with Taiwan. This could be in terms of sharing intelligence. It could be even in the sense of working together in the procurement of weapons, in the sense that, for example, the Japanese could pass on to Taiwan technical or technological information about particular kinds of more advanced dual-use technologies and so on. As I mentioned at the outset, the strategic dilemma between China and Japan adds a new layer of complexity to American strategic detailed strategic planning and operations in the area. The question of whether Japan offers more diplomatic opportunities for Taiwan, I think, has been is there. After all, the new economic agreements that were established, and there are more coming along between Taiwan and Japan, coincide with the free trade agreements that Taiwan has reached with Singapore and with New Zealand, again, as has been mentioned before. And of course, I'll re-emphasize the fact that Japan is much more concerned with keeping Taiwan separate from the United States than rather keeping Taiwan separate from China than is the case in Washington. And that may or may not be helpful for Taiwan in keeping a degree of separation from the mainland, because insofar as the Japanese are seen to act on that, it would clearly have a counter-reaction within China, and so far from reducing tensions across the strait, it may increase them. So that if you like, the Japan element in cross-strait relations is one that is heavily circumscribed, both on the American side and by Chinese reactions. Nevertheless, as long as the Japanese continue to play this in a non-provocative way, the Japanese relationship with Taiwan is bound to increase and to thicken in the coming years.
Thank you. So I have to keep this very short because we really are running out of time, but I did have some thoughts coming out of this panel, which is really a nice diverse grouping, I think, of presentations. But I'm glad we kind of started with Professor Huang's presentation, because I think that the gorilla always in the room is China. And so you have this kind of basic confrontation of this basic issue as he raises that China now sees, you know, if you're really looking at the Chinese dream, you need to have a peaceful environment for that dream to unfold. And so you have this policy of trying to be closer to your neighbors. And the contrast, though, the other thing we've seen is this conflict on some of the edges, particularly in the South China Sea and East China Sea. And what Bob said was talking about intimidation and coercion, which doesn't seem really to jive with that. And so you're trying to find some way to reconcile this problem of China, a foundation policy that's talking about needing peace, on the other hand, confrontational techniques. And your mention of history made me think about how the emperors used to do it in the past. In a Confucian system, emperors didn't need war at all because they were so benevolent that all the countries around them would go along with them very nicely because they're so benevolent. But you did have wars all the time. And how was that justified? It's when people didn't accept China's benevolence. Right, so if you reject the benevolence of the emperor, you've obviously passed the moral line to a certain degree, and you deserve to be intimidated and coerced. And so you have that, I think, the same kind of situation in China today. And the question is, how does Taiwan fit in all this? Obviously, Taiwan is not treated as just another nation neighbor that you have to be kind to because it's not considered in the same way. But you see the same dynamic where there has been a pressure towards economic relationships, more peaceful relationships. On the other hand, there's, you know, the underlying thing with the South China Sea and East China Sea, there's a sovereignty issue. And sovereignty issue can always get in the way of that attempt to try to frame this as a peaceful economic or other interest. And then that's when we move into the other papers, though. I think that underlying all this, you know, lots of interesting insights that I can't go into, but the extent to which that the gorilla in the room remains there. Michael's noticed that, you know, the context for improved relations between Taiwan and Japan really was improved relations between Taiwan and China. And so that it has some element of that. But also, you know, there's also elements that make that relationship work without that relationship with China, but it remains always in the background. You know, how is that relationship with China going to impede what Japan does with Taiwan, or what Taiwan's going to do with China. And I think we're talking about TPP, it's a whole other set of issues. You presented us with this very complicated set of issues, of course. We're talking about multilateral issues and bilateral issues over a wide range of different countries. And it's not just about country to country, it's also the different sectors inside each country, which you show very well, right? There are winners and losers in every country to make this more complicated. And yet there's also this overlay of the China issue there as well. You know, will China block Taiwan's participation in TPP? Or will China favor? What is China's position on TPP? I mean, there are a lot of questions that haven't really resolved themselves yet. So in some ways, you have this opportunity for a large kind of economic collaboration through TPP, but that unknown entity in many cases is still the Taiwan factor. So I think you see that underlay throughout all you're talking about. Anyway, we hardly have any time left. What I'd like to do is maybe we'll take a series of questions and then, you know, like five questions or something, see if people want to answer, and then we'll call it quits because I know many people have other things they want to go to. So any questions? Yeah. Professor Lee.
Thanks. I have a question for Professor Yehuda. I know that recently some Japanese legislators, most of them are LDP members, talk about the possibility of a Taiwan Relations Act between Taiwan and Japan, very, very similar to the one between Taiwan and the United States. So what is your viewpoints regarding this, the likelihood? Thanks.
So let's just see if we have any other questions people want to ask, and then we'll... Yeah.
I am very interested in this topic that Professor Alexander Huang was talking about, Ukraine and Taiwan. And I would like if he can expand a little more about this thing.
Okay. Others? If not, I'll let you answer. We'll see. I think we do, like when we get done, if there people have individual questions, you can always ask the panelists. We'll be hanging around a little bit, so we'll do that. So you want, Michael, you want to? Oh, sorry.
Well, clearly the TRA that's being talked about is different from that was passed in the United States, because Japan cannot replicate the security issue there. I think what they're talking about is trying to establish a legal basis for Japan's relationship with Taiwan. It's come from what is regarded in Japan as the Taiwan lobby. And I don't think they expect such a thing to pass. The government knows that this would be regarded as a hostile act by Beijing, and I don't think they expect it to be welcomed in Washington either. But it's a way of waving a flag, both for domestic politics. And a lot of, I hadn't really mentioned very much issues of domestic politics, which matter in both sides. But it's also a way of demonstrating, if you like, the depth of Japanese interest in Taiwan.
Alexander?
Okay, very quickly, Taiwan and Ukraine. Several points of observation. The first one, when the Ukrainian crisis erupted, from Taiwan, it would be seen by many in Taiwan as another distraction for the United States to its rebalancing toward Asia. How much that the United States will be distracted beyond the defense budget cut
beyond the difficulties of alliance management, how United States will redefine the so-called new type of great power relationship. Point number two, the biggest implication for Taiwan is the fait accompli. You know, because if Putin did it very quickly, that even Ukraine could not respond. For Taiwan, if China would adopt a kind of shock and awe or whatever actions against Taiwan, I don't think that the European Union or the United States would have time to respond. The third one is that if we look at Crimea or Ukraine as the core interest, buying the words from China, core interest of Russia, so you will put Ukraine in the middle, that Russia will never give away Ukraine, but the West may or may not. There is a difference in terms of degrees. Again, Taiwan is another core interest or the key core interest for China now. And so there is a kind of analogy. The fourth one would be that the Ukraine had helped China greatly in the past 20 years in terms of arms procurement and advancement of military modernization. Any change will have a trilateral dynamic between Russia, Ukraine, and China on this arms market. Last question, very simple. Is Xi Jinping another Vladimir Putin?
Preston, do you want to take a last? Do you have any last minute things you want to say, or about anything?
Okay. Thank you, Chairman. I think it's more and more important for Taiwan not to take sides. So the TPP and the RCEP will be all Taiwan's making efforts to entry into. And also, I think in the future, 2 or 3 years will be very crucial time for the Taiwan's entry, and would like to search to be engaged in the bilateral and the multilateral mechanism to be the contributions for Taiwan and the better scenario in the future. Thank you.
That's a very nice way to end this, I think. I was actually on a committee yesterday. We were setting out the ground rules. One of the ground rules are, no matter what, we always end on time. I never end on time, and we're already beyond our time. So we're going to have to call it quits, but I'm sure that everybody here will be very happy to answer other questions. I do want to again thank Danjiang University for participating with us, and particularly Dean Dai. This is really wonderful. We've had this collaborative relationship, and I hope we can continue to do similar things in the future. And so thanks to the panel for their presentations.
Thank you. Okay.